Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is investing and small business reporter and pod newbie, Angharad Carrick. And coming up, petrol prices down, energy looks set to go the same way, inflation is expected to significantly reduce over the year, and the latest GDP figures show we aren't in recession. So when on earth will the cost of our weekly shop follow suit? The mortgage price war, how low will they go? But woe tiger, says Simon, probably. Before we get too carried away, borrowers aren't out of the woods yet on the rate rise pain. Also today, should you invest in the BCT? What's the point of Bitcoin? And some much needed innovation in train ticketing. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, the price of everything has rocketed since the start of last year. You don't need me to tell you that, but CPI peaked at 11.1% in October, well above the Bank of England's 2% target. But the good news is it's expected to fall rather quickly this year. But what we pay at the supermarket has stayed and is expected to stay stubbornly high. So figures from Kantar this week show that households face an additional almost £800 hit to their annual grocery bill this year. And worryingly, it's on everyday products such as milk and eggs that we're seeing some of the steepest increases. So Anne, welcome to the pod. First time.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Most welcome. Cost of food. Why is it so high?
So food prices actually started rising just after the pandemic. We had a lot of supply chain issues, which meant it was harder to source the food, therefore making prices higher. Obviously, the Ukraine invasion has not helped. It means the price of energy has gone through the roof, which means that animal feed is more expensive and fertilizer is more expensive. So it's kind of a perfect storm for higher prices. On top of that, there are obviously UK-specific issues. Minimum wage has gone up, which means it's more expensive. There are fewer people in the fields picking vegetables and fruit, which has not helped. And there are just generally kind of serious supply issues. I don't know about you, but I can't get eggs anywhere at the moment.
I'm not a big egg eater. I hear this. No, yeah, I always have a pack in my fridge and then end up, sorry, it sounds awful, throwing them away because I never eat them. Eventually, when I discover that I've got that pack in the fridge that I've never eaten. I don't know why. I'm not an egg lover. Pickled eggs, on the other hand.
Oh,
big,
no.
Big fan.
No.
But they last forever. Do you know, I've not noticed any shortages. I have to be honest.
It depends where you go. Supermarket eggs, they're quite difficult to get hold of, and it depends which supermarket it is. Mm. But if you go closer to the source, i.e. not direct to the chicken, but you cut out more of the middlemen, then it is easier to get your handle on eggs.
Right.
So, for example, our local pub sells eggs that are produced nearby, and there's always eggs there. These chickens, they get everywhere. They're laying eggs all over the place. But yeah, the supermarket there's definitely a supermarket crunch there. Also, eggs have become part of the great global conspiracy as well, but we probably better not delve into that.
Wow, my egg knowledge is really limited, but thank you,
guys.
Oh,
if you fall down the egg hole, you will keep falling by quite a long way at the moment.
Okay, note to me, don't Google egg
Google Bill Gates and eggs, yeah.
Oh, everything's got to relate to Bill Gates, though, hasn't it?
Yeah.
We digress. The worst thing about, I guess, I mean, high food prices hit us all, but it is hitting essentials, as I mentioned there at the start, which is, of course, going to hit those households that can't shoulder that extra cost. And food is one area that we can't not have. You can turn to your heating down and put on a jumper, but you can't stop eating. Well, I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think when you look at the price rises in the ONS figures, it is basics like milk, cheese, bread, eggs, if you can get your hands on them. They rose, I think it was about 4% compared to 1% the previous year. So that's it. That is a lot. That's a huge amount in a year. And then things like sugar, jam, honey, chocolate. I mean, maybe they aren't seen as essentials, but you need your milk, you need your cheese, you need your bread. Well, I think also lower income households spend more of their household budget on their food and energy bills as well. So yeah, it is having a bigger impact on poorer households.
I mentioned there at the starting that, you know, inflation is expected to significantly reduce. You know, at the moment we had some GDP figures, we're not in recession. You know, things are starting to, after having, and we'll talk about mortgage rates in a minute, look, dare I say it, on the up. I mean, but food is, those prices seem really stubborn. I mean, what are we expecting? When are they going to fall?
It's really hard to know. Grocery kind of price inflation has been the one stubborn kind of thing where inflation has maybe peaked. There's kind of constant headlines about, you know, food prices are still going to go up. I think it's really hard to know, partly because the Ukraine invasion has had such an impact. That's obviously still ongoing. We're sort of waiting to see how that plays out. Mm. And I think all of the factors that I mentioned at the start, the energy, feed, fertilizer, it takes about a year for those costs to kind of filter through to the prices we see on the shelves. The good news, though, is that food prices are generally falling, and have done for a couple of months, but they're still really high. So it's like our energy bills. Everyone's saying, you know, they're down X percent, but we are not used to paying that, and we haven't been used to paying that. So they are going to fall, but I don't think they're going to fall as much as we maybe expect.
Or hope. Simon, in your article on this subject, I'm not asking this question. You are, not you personally, whoever wrote the article on this. Are supermarkets ramping up costs unnecessarily? My eyebrows just gone up, by the way. Are brands just cashing in while they can? Oh, it's the cost of living. We need to, you know, supply issues. And we're just going to increase it a little bit more than we would have otherwise.
Well, firstly, you need to separate the supermarkets and the brands here, don't you? Because there's the supermarkets, there's the stuff that they sell, and then there's the companies that sell to them. And if it's a brand name product, then it has what is described by Warren Buffett as a moat, a defense, pricing power. It can put up its prices. So when, for example, Unilever, you know, one of the world's largest consumer goods companies, is facing inflation, Unilever has the power to put up prices of stuff because Ben and Jerry's and Hellman's and Marmite are brand names, and people won't trade to alternatives from them because they think they're better. Maybe there are substitutes for those things. Maybe there aren't. I've never had a Marmite substitute that really comes up to scratch. And actually, again, Marmite, you don't want to delve too much into the price of that, because we've had some funny stories about the price of Marmite going up and down in the past, long before this inflation shock.
Bill Gates' fault?
He never got the blame for that, but right, it's almost certain that he was behind it.
I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. He's also personally responsible for the fact that Teams tries to take over your computer as well.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Every time you start up your computer, Teams tries to start up and take it over. He sits there at night personally orchestrating that. The thing about the supermarkets and the brands is the supermarkets argue that they're trying to keep prices down. And they have been, they have this wonderful phrase where they announce that they're investing X number of million in lower prices. Investing in lower prices basically amounts to, we're not going to charge you more for stuff and make more money off you. So they're investing profits that they would have otherwise made into lower prices. This is quite funny. It's like that thing where you get a tax break but actually the tax break is just you not paying some tax. That's not you being given any money, but it's presented to you as you're being given some money. It's like you're just not handing over money. Now, the supermarkets say they're investing in lower prices, and there has been a bit of a bit of competition here and a bit of a price war going on with some of this stuff. Obviously, you've got the likes of Tesco and Sainsbury's trying to go toe-to-toe with Aldi and Lidl, who are coming along and stealing their lunch because they do genuinely tend to have lower prices across stuff. Then you've got others like nipping in and out of the mix. M&S and Ocado got involved in this, interestingly. When M&S and Ocado originally did the tie-up, M&S cut a load of prices on loads of stuff. The M&S Ocado tie-up has been quite successful. And if you notice the price of some of that stuff in M&S, it's started going back up in price now, which presumably is they managed to do very, very, very well. They had some keen prices and they're like, right, we've got some people in using our online shopping thing with Ocado. We can afford to put the prices back up. I don't use M&S Ocado to buy online shopping, but I do buy stuff in the shops, and M&S have cut the prices in the shops as well. But it's one of those things where quite you suspect that, you know, someone is pulls on a string in one place and it adjusts something over here in a completely different place as well. They've got a lot of very smart people trying to work out how they maintain their margins. Now, one of the things there has been is a row between some of the supermarkets and some of the consumer giants, with supermarkets say you are whacking up prices way too much. The chairman of Tesco has been quite outspoken on that, said companies were using inflation as an excuse to hike prices further than necessary. If you look at Unilever's results, which were out this week, then Unilever said our costs have gone up substantially, but we have managed to maintain sales because we put the prices of stuff up. So across the board, I think the average was 11.3% for Unilever. It's quite hefty price rises. And we had a story about this last month, actually, talking about some of these steep price rises from different brands. You know, Heinz cream of tomato soup, which is produced by Kraft Heinz. The price of a tin, a 400 gram tin, on January the 18th, 2022, 98p. The price of a 400 gram tin on January the 18th, 2023, £1.70. That is a 73% increase. Ouch. So then you get to the question of, okay, it's tomato soup. There's a lot of different tomato soups on the shelf in your supermarket. There are other brands. There are the supermarket's own brands. There's probably a value tin of tomato soup. Will you trade to one of those? Now, here's the question. If you really like Heinz cream of tomato soup, and that's the thing you've grown used to the taste of, is one of those things going to be an adequate substitute? Now, for many people, the answer would be, yeah, I can have a different tomato soup. That's fine. But for quite a lot of them as well, the answer would be, no, I only like the Heinz one. I've tried the others and I don't like the others. I mean, I always buy Heinz ketchup. I don't think other ketchup tastes like Heinz ketchup. And I've been, is Heinz ketchup better? Or have I just been programmed and brainwashed? So I always buy Heinz ketchup.
You have far more sophisticated taste buds than I do, Simon, because honestly, I don't think I could taste the difference.
So the other thing I was going to say, of course, is if you look at the value stuff, the reason why some of the prices of the value stuff have gone up by quite a lot is because there's so much less margin on it. So the costs are almost equal the price. And in fact, some of these things are probably loss leaders where they're selling them at less than it costs them to produce them or put them on the shelves once they factor in all of their costs. And so, yeah, you can see why that gets bumped up by quite a lot, whereas there's a bit more fat on a tin of Heinz tomato soup. Now, Kraft Heinz has defended itself and said its costs have gone up massively, I should say, when this story was run, these numbers were run. I do know that the one section of the food supply chain that isn't doing great out of this is farmers. I mean, my brother-in-law is a farmer. They're vegetable farmers, and they are not making out like bandits. This is not feeding through to them making lots more money. In fact, it's feeding through to most farmers making less money. Farmers are really feeling the squeeze at the moment.
So, Simon, when do you think our prices are going to fall? Because it's one of those things. If you raise the price of a can of tomato soup, I mean, obviously, it depends on which supermarket you go in and da-da-da, but they're not going to bring it back to where it was. Ever, are they?
I don't know. You'd think not. You would think once that price of tomato soup gets to £1.70. But there does come a point where, the elasticity stop. It becomes the point where people stop buying these things. They're like, I am not buying that anymore. That is way too expensive. And you also have to remember that food and groceries is a highly competitive area. And you do see the price of stuff fall substantially. So it could come back down. Whether the price of our shopping is going to come back down to where it was, I don't necessarily think so. I think, unfortunately, there's an element here where you're going to have the price of what your shopping was plus a chunk on top of that, and that's going to be what your shopping costs in future. I don't necessarily think that maybe it will be your shopping costs as much as it does now. Maybe there will probably be a peak and we come down from the peak. hopefully, because actually some of those other costs, if energy costs and transport costs and other things do come down, transport costs have come down somewhat due to the lower cost of fuel, not massively, but they have come down somewhat. Energy prices are falling, and so on. You might get a slight solution to the worker problem that people have, and so on and so on. Then, you know, the cost pressure could come down, and you could see retailers and big brands go, right, okay, we could afford to cut prices a bit.
Right, let's move on from food. Now, are we in a mortgage rate war? 5-year fixed deals have hit sub 4% for the first time since rates shot up last autumn. It's after HSBC's 5-year offering hit the market at 3.99%. They've also unveiled a 2-year fixed deal at a competitive 4.44%. Now, previously, the only mortgage below 4% was Virgin Money's 10-year fixed deal, and that was launched earlier this month. And all of this, despite the Bank of England still raising rates, Simon. So why are mortgage rates still dropping?
It is a slightly puzzling and unusual situation. The Bank of England base rate is moving in one direction and mortgage rates are moving in the opposite direction. It's actually the opposite of what monetary policy is designed to do. Monetary policy is designed to increase the cost of borrowing and therefore reduce demand for it. So is monetary policy bust? Have we seen the end of monetary policy? Should we just give up on interest rates? No, not really. What's happening here is that a number of factors are coming into play. Firstly, you need to look at the fallout from the mini budget, the ill-fated, disastrous, chaotic, whatever word you want to preface mini budget with. Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng might have been right about the fact that this country needs more growth and maybe needs to get out of the funk that it's in. But boy, did they bungle delivering a colossal amount of debt-funded tax cuts, which combined with the pension industry playing with investment fire to deliver a mini financial crisis, at which point banks and building societies took one look at what was going on, the fact that there were now expectations that the base rate was going to rocket up way higher than they thought, concerns over, you know, the bond markets, all these kinds of things, and picked up their ball and went home. Said, we'll come out to play later. They pulled big chunks of their mortgage ranges and the rates on the scraps that were left went up substantially. So the average 5-year fixed rate rocketed all the way up to above 6.5% in late October. Okay, bear in mind that a year before that, it was knocking around 2.5%, and that is a colossal rise. Now, what then happened was we saw a semblance of calm brought back into the markets. Kwasi was given the boot. Liz had to jump ship. Jeremy Hunt came in as Chancellor, did his stern school teacher thing. The fun police, right, that's it, kids. No tax cuts. We're putting all your taxes up. We're reversing this. We're reversing that. And markets decided that they liked that a bit more. The Bank of England also stepped in to try to solve the crisis driven by pension funds investing in complicated, risky, derivative-based investments. And that sort of, you know, very much calmed the waters. And so the expectation that rates were going to have to rocket up very much came back down a bit. Banks and building societies had a bit more confidence. And you've started to see rates come down ever since. So rates have been kind of, they went up like a rocket and they've been coming down, not like a feather, a bit faster than that, but they have been coming down ever since. You've seen the recalibration, basically. The other factor at play is also that banks and building societies, they're in quite a good financial position at the moment. This isn't like the financial crisis where they went into the financial crisis and their finances were absolutely shot. They have good balance sheets and they're pretty keen to lend and to make profits. And they're very keen to make profits on higher interest rates, which help banks get, you know, build up those profits between their saving and their lending and so on. Arguably, we've ended up back in a position where banks and building societies are perhaps keener to lend to people than people are to borrow. When you look at people purchasing homes, there's been a real crash in home buying interest. So we're seeing competition there and they're cutting prices in order to try to get in customers rather than what we saw after the mini budget where they hiked prices to scare customers off. And then finally, there's also the expectation that we're near the peak for rates, that the Bank of England is going to hold steady once inflation starts to drop properly. Inflation has already come down slightly. it's expected to suddenly start falling very quickly. And when that happens, there's the thought the Bank of England will hold fire. There is, we talked about this last week, people think we may even be quite close to the peak now. There are some people who think we might even be at the peak, but the consensus is we're going to get to 4.5% or 4.25%. Put all those things together, mortgage market looks a lot less scary than it did a few short months ago, and you've got the conditions for rates to come down. And that's what's been happening. So back below 4%, you know, realistically, the difference between you taking out a mortgage at 3.99% and 4.16%, for example, is not a huge amount of money, right? It adds up, you know, that small amount on monthly payments once you stretch it out over 2 or 5 years, for example, but it's not a huge amount of money, but it's a benchmark, isn't it? Below 4%. Question is, how far will they fall? We're going to get to, are we going to get to a 3.5% 5 year fix, for example?
Simon, rates might be falling. Have we reached a peak? Not sure, which is better news, of course. But put it in the context of what's going on in the wider property market. Are there lots of houses available? Are people still trying to chance their arm on the highest amount that they can get for properties? Are banks more willing to lend to first-time buyers in terms of the ratio, income ratio? What is the wider outlook at the moment? Where are we? Because there was an article the other day that was saying the best time to buy a property will be March or something like that, March the 14th or something random. Is that right? Is that when house prices are going to fall and there's going to be loads of properties on the market and da-da-da?
In theory, the best time to buy anything is when other people don't want to buy it. That is when you are going to get the keenest price. That relies on there being a supply of those things for you to purchase, though, which... The problem with the property market and trying to buy when nobody wants to sell is that if there is no catalyst for people to have to sell, then you can discover that there are not many places to buy. So what we've seen is something of a crash in home buying interest, but we've also seen a crash in interest from people in putting their houses on the market. So unless they have to sell, they're not putting them on, they're like, oh, maybe I'll wait until later down the line when things settle down. Things have settled down now a bit. I think maybe you might see a bit of an uptick in this over spring, but they don't have to accept lower prices. So you've got the sort of the rise of the, you know, of the sit on your hands seller who's like, fine, I'll put my house on the market. If I don't get the offer I want, I'll just leave it sitting there. Because, and they've got no incentive or little incentive to accept an offer to get it sold because they can't find anything to buy themselves. So this is why during the pandemic price boom, although people were ended up paying more for properties, and after the stamp duty cut had been in place for a certain amount of time, there was a false economy there where you were saving maybe £15,000 in stamp duty, but you were paying £30,000 more for the property than you were a year ago. But there was a degree of what in investment terms is called liquidity in the market, where it was kind of easier to buy and sell because you had more transactions going on. I think we're back to a sort of the Brexit negotiation years, which were the property market was in the doldrums, 2019-ish kind of thing. And it wasn't that prices were falling so much, it was that nobody was really interested in buying and selling. So this is a frustration, for example, for first-time buyers who don't have to sell something in order to buy, is that in theory, although mortgage rates are higher at the moment, lower than they were, but much higher than they were before that, so it's costing them more on a monthly basis, they should be able to try to get themselves a good deal by negotiating on a property because there's less people who want to buy it. They don't have to bid above asking price and so on at the moment. But I've been talking to quite a few people who are in that position going, yeah, actually, we've decided to try and take advantage of this. And then they're saying, well, the problem is the prices aren't really coming down because there just isn't really anything to buy. There's hardly any choice. So you end up in a bit of a catch-22 situation. I would still say that if someone is considering buying or considering moving home, this isn't a bad time to be doing it because you can definitely negotiate, but you need to put the work in to find somebody on the other end who has a reason for in that negotiation? What can those reasons be? For example, one of the classic ones is someone's inherited. You know, it's a probate sale. Somebody's died, the family's inherited it. They don't want to keep, most of the time, they don't want to keep property. So they'd like to sell it. So they're going to be keen to sell. They're not just going to sit on that property. Is it a buy-to-let landlord? There's lots of buy-to-let landlords at the moment who want to get out of the market and have made quite a lot of money and see this differently to homeowners, because homeowners look at it as, how am I going to get enough money to buy the next place? And the next place is invariably more expensive, so they need as much as possible. Some of these buy-to-let landlords are sitting on six-figure profits built up over the long term, and they're looking at it going, well, I've made quite a lot of money on this property, and I definitely want to try and sell it now before I probably end up getting hit for more tax in the future and my costs are going up, and I'd actually be quite glad to get out of this game. So they're not bad people to try and buy off. And then obviously you also have, you know, the unfortunate people who are forced sellers due to financial circumstances and stuff like that, which, you know, in all honesty, it's always going to feel bad taking advantage of someone like that to try and negotiate a better price. But if you want to try and buy a property for the best price, you're going to have to try and negotiate the best possible price, whoever you're buying off.
Simon, though, in your article, the best five-year fixed mortgages are back below 4%, but borrowers aren't out of the wood yet on the rate rise pain, says Simon Lambert. You say, and I quote, "I cannot help but feel we might be being too sanguine, and perhaps rates have gone up so rapidly that we haven't really clocked the full impact yet." Talk to me, Simon.
Well, yes, I think there might be an issue here. And I think this is actually potentially true both of, in terms of things like where interest rates hit people, mortgages, consumer debt, and so on, they hit where they hit the real economy. And also for investors, I think if you look at the stock market after having a pretty dire year last year in terms of the global stock market and the US stock market, whereas the FTSE 100 actually managed to deliver a positive total return, trod water in price terms, but once you include dividends, it actually delivered people a positive return. This year, however, there's been quite a good start to the year. It's one of the best starts to the year for stock markets on record. So do we just not need to worry about these interest rate rises anymore? You know, it's like, oh, well, we're near the top. It's fine. You know, we're done. Markets have decided that basically they can deal with they don't like uncertainty. The uncertainty of rates going up much faster than they thought last year rocked them. How do we price stuff in this different world to the one that we were in before? They've grown used to it. They're now like, okay, well, we can probably deal with rates at, you know, 4 or 5%. That's fine. You know, it'll be okay. They're probably not going to go much higher. As long as they don't go much higher, we're fine. We won't throw a wobbly. And I think the same is true of this look at the real economy. If you look at the Bank of England monetary policy report last week, it had a line in it that was like buried quite deep into the report. And it basically said about 1.7 million people facing, you know, major rises in their mortgage costs that on average would be about £3,000 a year. That's a lot of money to suck out of people's pockets, £3,000 a year, especially once you add it on to the cost of food that we were talking about earlier, the cost of energy that feeds into the cost of food, that feeds into the cost of everything else. And some people are facing much more pain than that. And it filters through to the rental market as well, because unfortunately, it is quite a lot of buy-to-let landlords facing, because they have interest-only mortgages, they face very large jumps, and they are unfortunately going to try to put, or are already pushing up people's rents off the back of it. And there just seems to be this kind of idea that, okay, it was fine, we can deal with this. Actually, do you know what? If you'd said to us a year ago, rates at 4%, we'd have gone, whoa, economy's not going to be able to handle that. We're going to totally crash it. Today, we just had some GDP figures in showing that we thought we were in recession. We aren't in recession yet. Maybe we might even dodge a recession. So there seems to be this idea that it's okay. But the flip side to that is that potentially interest rates have gone up so fast over the past year that it hasn't all caught up with us properly yet. There is the, you know, I'm an optimist, so I hope that this isn't true. I hope that it is okay. And I also think interest rates should not be at 0.5% or 0.1% permanently. I think they should be at about 4%. I think that's probably where they should be. So I hope that the opposite of this is true. But there is a part of me that thinks, are we underestimating the full impact of this? And is it yet to filter through as all of a sudden 1.7 million people suddenly discover that they have on average £3,000 less this year on top of the cost of everything else going up, and how that then has a knock-on effect as they cut back on their spending and the decisions that they make, some of them fall into financial difficulty and things like that.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, how's the last week been?
Yeah, I said last week I thought markets would retreat a little bit, and they've done exactly that. Broken clocks are right twice a day, aren't they? After a strong start to the year, we just needed to catch our breath a little bit before having the next reason to potentially go higher. So reasons why for the move lower, to be honest, I'm not putting it down to one thing in particular. It could be that people are a little bit worried about next week's inflation report out of the US. It could be profit taking after the good start to the year, or it could be Google's share price coming under pressure that influences the market a little bit. But for sure, right now, nothing to really worry about, in my opinion. Elsewhere, UK GDP was less bad than expected, which just delays the recession a little bit more. Bank of England think that will last into 2024. Last week was a busy one with all the rate decisions, earnings and US jobs numbers. This week was this a chance for the market to catch its breath, relax a little bit before things get juicy again next week?
So what do we have to look forward to next week then?
Yeah, number one most important event will be the US inflation print. So we've been moving lower month on month for six readings in a row, which has been great. Markets loved it, and the main reason that we're trading where we are right now. The market would like to make that seven readings in a row. If we were, however, to get a spike higher in that inflation number, I would expect significant volatility in the market to come under pressure. Elsewhere, UK inflation as well. And also the jobs report. UK inflation is expected to show another decline, and bullish investors everywhere will hope that is the case. For those that like to judge the economy on how retail sales are doing, we have those from the UK and the US next week, as well as the Eurozone GDP report. Earnings from popular companies include Coca-Cola, Airbnb, Cisco, Glencore and Nestle. But hopefully by the time we get to this time next week, market survived the latest inflation prints, and we have our reason to continue the strong start to the year.
So essentially, markets like any kind of news that makes it look like interest rates are only going to go up a little bit more and then stop. Anything else, they're not going to be happy.
Exactly that. I mean, if I was someone who wanted volatility, you would want to see a really, really, really high inflation number. But hopefully, there's not many people out there like that.
Okay, Sam, thank you very much for that. Speak to you next week.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Now, 2022 was a brutal year for markets. Economic woes and geopolitical volatility led investors to pull their cash from equities and bonds. Venture capital trusts, VCTs, by contrast, well, they continued to attract rather strong interest. Investment saw a 68% increase in the last year. The generous tax breaks VCTs offer have long attracted investors, but it is the companies that they invest in that is getting people really excited. So is it time to get involved in VCTs? Ang, you've been chatting to the manager of the UK's largest VCT, Malcolm Ferguson, this week. But before we get to what he's been telling you, VCTs?
So VCTs are listed vehicles that invest in young, usually privately owned companies. Although they do sometimes invest in companies on the junior market, they tend to be privately owned. As you said, they become really, really popular with younger investors as well. So one of the main benefits is obviously the tax breaks. You can claim up to 30% income tax relief on the amount invested, provided that you hold the investment for 5 years. They also offer tax-free capital gains and tax-free dividends. So that's one of the really, really big draws, I think, for a lot of investors. But one of the big things that is getting people excited is the fact that they give investors access to really exciting, innovative companies, and which just aren't going public anymore. You know, we've seen the likes of Deliveroo, Wise that have listed and not gone particularly well. So I think with more startups sort of looking at that, they are turning their backs on public markets, at least at the earliest stages, which means that investors like us are missing out on the chance to invest in some really, really exciting companies.
Flip side of that, just because I'm miserable, and because they're new and innovative and all that sort of thing, it might be a little bit more risky.
Yes. Yeah. It's a high risk investment. And probably one that a kind of more experienced investor would go for. I think the biggest risk at the moment with VCTs are valuations. So a lot of VCTs are probably taking advantage of those lower valuations that we're seeing across tech and kind of growth sectors to invest at a lower valuation. It's cheaper for them. But it also means that their portfolio companies are seeing their valuations take a hit. So if you kind of look at some of the results of these VCTs, they are basically having to say that they've lost, I don't know, 3-4 million because some of their companies have had to take a hit. And usually it's in the more sort of deep tech, techie side of things and consumer.
So you've been speaking to Malcolm Ferguson. Who he?
So Malcolm is, he took over the Octopus Titan VCT, which is the UK's largest VCT. They have been behind some really big deals. So Depop, where you kind of sell secondhand clothes, they were bought by Etsy a couple of years ago for 1.6 billion. Octopus Titan were one of their early backers. They also backed Cazoo, which listed in New York a couple of years ago too. So, they've got a huge portfolio. It's over 100, I think, now. They have invest across consumer, health, deep tech, artificial intelligence. They've got a huge, broad portfolio, which I imagine is probably why they're one of the most popular. At the moment, they've invested in the sort of past year or so. Malcolm said that they've been really, really interested in artificial intelligence, which is obviously a big thing at the moment with ChatGPT and the kind of buzz around that. So they've actually invested in a robot strawberry picker. Which picks the reddest and ripest strawberries in a field. So they were very excited about that. But they also have invested in kind of more consumer and food related businesses. So they are investing across the board, which makes it very exciting and very interesting.
Well, I'm curious what they're investing in. As optimistic as I tried to sound at the start of the pod, troubled times, should we say?
Yeah, I think obviously with the kind of looming recession and everything that has sort of led up to this point, it's really, really difficult for early stage companies at the moment. We've seen obviously huge layoffs in the tech sector, which I imagine has not helped confidence at all. But Malcolm said that actually venture capitalists quite like the opportunities that recessions bring. I think they're probably the only ones to enjoy that. But he basically said that it all comes down to something called funding scarcity. So if there are kind of mass redundancies across these big tech companies, it means that there's a lot of talent that these startups, early stage companies can recruit, because historically it's been really, really hard for them to get any kind of talent because the likes of Google, Uber, Spotify have essentially snapped them up. The lack of funding also can drive down competition, which can help a startup. So while I was kind of initially skeptical that recessions can be good, actually it makes a lot of sense. You know, you see quite a few after 2008, you had Uber and Zoopla, and in the dot-com bubble, you had kind of PayPal, Booking.com. So you can see that after a big change, lots of interesting companies kind of come up to deal with the problems.
Simon, VCTs, your view?
I think they can be a good investment. They have some very tax-friendly benefits. It's a 30% income tax relief, but it means you have to hold them long-term. But if you're making this kind of investment, then it should be long-term. You need to understand how you make your returns from a VCT, which don't come from the value of that VCT rising in value, because they are structured, they are an investment trust. So it's not that the share price rises in value, it's that they pay out most of those returns to you in dividends. Over the years, and those dividends can be quite lumpy. You might get special payments here and there rather than regular payments, so it's not an income investment, but it does manage allow you to invest in exciting early stage companies in a portfolio approach rather than sticking your money into these things individually. And because the majority of these will fail, they will never fulfill their promise, but the ones that do succeed, this tiny number that do succeed, are the ones that make, you know, really big gains. That's how venture capital investing works. That's how early stage investing works. That's how an angel investor does it and things like that. But it's not how lots of people who get interested in this stuff do it. Instead, they go on to maybe one of the crowdfunding sites and they back one or two things that they're interested in. And that's not enough. You do need quite a broad portfolio. And, you know, they are specialist managers. And I think they are very interesting investments. They're very interesting investments for people who, for some other reason, cannot invest, for example, more money into an ISA or more money into a pension. So as an alternative to that stuff. But don't let the tax tail of, you know, what is it? Don't let the tax tail wag the dog or whatever. I can't remember.
Something like that.
It's something like that. Basically, don't just do it for tax reasons. Mm. Do it because it's the right investment for you, and think about it quite carefully. And bear in mind that costs are quite high as well. Management fees on these things are substantial because it's far more, you know, it's more of a niche market, so they can charge higher fees. But also there is the element where it is more expensive to do this kind of stuff if you do it properly than it is to run a global fund that just invests in the shares of companies listed on the stock market.
You were nodding along there, Ang, when Simon talked about fees.
Yeah, it's significantly more expensive. And, you know, they will kind of say that there is good reason for that. And, you know, it is a kind of curated portfolio, and whether or not it's kind of worth, I don't know, 5% or something, is one to be debated. But it is a lot more than kind of a normal fund. But yeah, as Simon says, it is a lot riskier, and investors should consider that.
Go in with your eyes wide open. Yeah?
Exactly that.
Is there anything else Malcolm told you that you thought, that's interesting?
Yeah, so I think quite often when you speak to these managers, they want to speak about all of the successes that they've had. And quite rarely do they open up and say, actually, I've made a bit of a mistake there. So I asked him kind of what his biggest maybe regret was in terms of investing. And one of the things that he said he had done, he passed up on the opportunity to invest in the challenger banks, so the Monzos, Revoluts, because he just didn't understand how anyone would be interested in ever opening a bank account with someone that isn't, you know, Barclays, NatWest, Santander. And, you know, I think for a long time, lots of people did just use it for holiday money. So I understand where he's coming from. But it was just quite an interesting chat about, you know, the reasons why he thought it was quite a bad business model, and obviously now he's hugely regretting that.
Well, I'm sure he's doing all right. Now, we've spoken about Britcoin before on the pod. I think it was 2001 that Rishi was first mooting it, so of course we discussed it. But the digital currency could be a step closer after a consultation was launched this week by the Treasury. Now, it could even be here in the next decade. But what on earth is a Britcoin? How will it work? Why are the Bank of England and the government so keen to get involved in crypto? And what's in it for us? Simon, Britcoin, a potted history.
Does anybody else get the suspicion that if Rishi Sunak wasn't the Prime Minister and previously the Chancellor, he'd be exactly the kind of guy who'd be sitting there telling you at work about how he put some money into crypto and he'd been doing really well recently. And actually, now he's got interested in this other one. And yeah, okay, Bitcoin, Ethereum, that's fine. But this one could really, really change things. And actually, the use for this could be amazing. And yes, I've put some money in at an early stage there, and I think this really could be a good thing. I think Rishi's the kind of guy who he wouldn't just get a bit of Bitcoin and a bit of Ethereum in his account, he'd be reading the white papers, he'd be doing this kind of stuff, and he'd be telling you all about it and being really excited about it.
Which essentially what's happening now, no?
Yeah, but like someone let him be in charge of the country's finances, and then he basically tried to become the person in charge of the country, and then some other people got in charge of the country, and then we had to get him in charge of the country because the other people didn't do a great job. So yeah, he's managed to indulge his passion project as prime minister now.
Yeah.
And he's roped Jeremy Hunt in and the Bank of England. I think it's slightly more complex than that. Yeah. But you get that kind of sense. Look, Gritcoin. So the question here is, why on earth are we pushing ahead with this? Crypto's a busted flush, isn't it? You know, it's just a gamble. It's just people trying to make money, get Lambo money, high risk trading. It collapsed. FTX, massive fraud, Sam Bankman-Fried, all this kind of nonsense. It's a dud. If you put all of that soap opera stuff to one side, underlying this whole thing, there is some interesting stuff that alternative reality Rishi would be very happy to tell you all about. But just because some of the crypto world is total Wild West madness, just because most of the crypto world is total Wild West madness, doesn't mean that there isn't a bit that actually is quite interesting and quite valuable and potentially could be the future of finance and so on. That's why we're still looking at Bitcoin. What Bitcoin is or would be is a central bank digital currency. So using the blockchain, you create a digital currency. What it also is the antithesis of some of the ideas behind cryptocurrencies themselves, you know, in their inception, which was that they were decentralized, anonymous. They were not controlled by one central organization. Instead, they were, you know, the control went to the people. It was, you know, effectively an anarchist movement. The Bank of England, the Treasury, and the government are not anarchists, just to be clear, in case anybody thinks that they might be. At times you look at the government and think they might be anarchists, but they're not anarchists. And what they want is a digital currency that they can control. It would be pegged to the price of a real currency, i.e. the pound. So it would be what's known as a so-called stable coin. It doesn't fluctuate wildly like Bitcoin or Ethereum or other cryptos. And £10 in Bitcoin, digital pounds, would have the same value as a £10 banknote. It would be built using the blockchain. It would be tokenized. It would be stored in a digital wallet. You'd be able to access it on your phone, smart card, all that kind of stuff. Why is this any different to spending money on your bank card from your bank account? Well, because that does actually still rely on private companies. I mean, Visa and MasterCard and the banks totally control that market. And also, if you have a digital currency, you can then start to do some interesting stuff around controlling how it can be used and what happens with it. So we talked about monetary policy earlier. Monetary policy is quite an imprecise science because the Bank of England puts up interest rates. That raises the cost of borrowing effectively for banks and building societies who then pass on the higher cost of borrowing to their customers, which lowers the demand for borrowing from businesses and from individuals. So less money is created and goes into the economy and it slows the economy down. You can end up in a weird scenario where you're busily putting up interest rates and banks are busy cutting mortgage rates, as we talked about earlier. Now, if you've got a central bank digital currency, you can start doing this stuff directly. You can start influencing the cost of borrowing, you know, directly. You push a button and it happens with the digital currency. You can also do things like unorthodox monetary policy, where, for example, you can stimulate the economy, but you can make it that that money has to be spent. Otherwise, it loses its value. So if you go to furlough, for example, or a better example is the helicopter money stuff in America, where they sent people checks. Now, what you want people to do with that money is you want them to spend it. You either want them to spend it because you want to support them because they're struggling. For example, furlough, they were supporting people who would have otherwise lost their jobs. And you want it to be going on the essentials. If you would, the American helicopter money, they were giving people money because they wanted to stimulate the economy. They wanted people to go out and spend that money. And also they were kind of trying to help them with the essentials and stuff like that. But that money can find its way into places that you don't want it to find its way into. For example, in America, quite a bit of that stimulus money found its way into lockdown traders punting on, you know, high risk stocks. If you do it with a central bank digital currency, you could make it that that central bank digital currency could only be spent on certain things. For example, it could only be spent on essentials, food shopping, your bills, and so on. It couldn't physically go into a trading account. Now, obviously, people could just take the money that they would have spent on food and put it in the trading account instead or whatever. But, you know, or you can use stimulus. You can time limit the money. Here's some money. In 30 days' time, if you haven't spent it, it ceases to exist. That's why central bankers like the idea of central bank digital currencies. Now, then there are some serious concerns over this stuff because it could bring in degrees of control. Right. You can all of a sudden, if people have their money digitized, you could stop people spending it. In Canada, when we saw the trucker protests, there was some pretty weird stuff and pretty heavy duty stuff that went on with people being locked out of their bank accounts and things like that. Now, it doesn't take much of a leap of an imagination into a sci-fi world to be thinking about ways that governments could use extra control over people's money to limit dissent, or, you know, shut people down who they don't like what they're doing and so on. And that's why there's a lot of concern about central bank digital currencies. But as I said, just because there's this concern about this, just because there's worries about what kind of weird stuff central banks could get up to with this and everything like that, doesn't mean that as a government, as a treasury, as a central bank, you shouldn't be exploring this, because, you know, part of your job is to be, you know, at the forefront of what's going on, not just running behind it, desperately trying to catch up.
But give me, Simon, I know that when you spoke about how this can be used for nefarious reasons, I did instantly think of certain other governments around the world that have proposed this idea. Would it work as sort of individual countries? Would it be better having a global sort of money? Now we're really going off into the distance here, but
don't think we want to go down that rabbit hole, do we?
I don't know. Like, no. That's the immediate thing that I think of
a global currency, but you're not allowed to use it to buy eggs.
I mean, you know, not around where you live, it's fine.
I think it would just end up being like Esperanto, wouldn't it? The global language that everyone was going to speak, so they didn't have to learn all these other languages.
Do they just end up speaking English though?
Well, yeah, the global currency is the dollar, isn't it, really? It is interesting. I think with any of these things, if you try and force these things on people who don't want them, they're just often not interested. And it actually often proves impossible to force these things on people. There's a lot of concern over the decline of cash spending, because the great thing about cash is it is anonymous. Nobody's tracking your spending. And you might think, well, I've got nothing to hide, so I've got nothing to fear. But we live in, you know, a society where surveillance is all too prevalent. And also, we don't know what people are doing with our data. We don't know who they're selling it to. There's loads of places, you know, where that goes on and you know nothing about it. And actually, there is a lot to be said, you know, for cash. And there are some countries where cash use is much, much higher than it is in the UK. And people are, you know, much more resolute in refusing to let go of cash. Never ceases to amaze me how in Europe they are absolutely willing in so many places to accept unbelievably high denomination banknotes when try getting rid of a £50 note in this country. It is not an easy task. You walk into a bakery in France, pay with a 50 euro note, they have got no problem with it whatsoever. I don't know, but I think Bitcoin, is it going to change the world? Is it going to come along and all of a sudden we'll be spending Bitcoins instead of pounds? No.
Look at you, Mr. Moneybags, in the corner with your 50 quids. And I thought this was supposed to be the appeal of crypto, is that you can trace it, you didn't have the banks involved, et cetera, sort of turning the original idea of it on its head a little bit. What are your thoughts? Are we likely to get it?
I mean, I find it astonishing that, you know, small state Tories think this could possibly be a good idea. I'm not sure how it chimes with their general kind of outlook. I probably won't happen because we're still waiting on Rishi's NFT from the Treasury, which is yet to be released. I think there are some good points, as Simon outlined, but I think there are some challenges there. I think not least because how do you encourage people to use it? We all know how annoying it is to change bank accounts and that sort of thing. So I'm not sure people will see the point, to be perfectly honest. If it's only for the benefit of the Treasury or the Bank of England, I think people will just say, well, I'll just use my card or Apple Pay or whatever it is. I'm not overly thrilled with the idea, partially because I can't be bothered. I don't want to have to think about something else. So I think adoption will be the big thing. And I imagine the Treasury will work that out pretty quickly once this consultation's over.
I like that as a reasoning. You can stay on this pod. Can't be bothered. Yeah, fair enough. Totally agree with you. Right, finally, train tickets. Now, if ever innovation was needed in one area of our lives, I sense that this might be it. But could a new app help in our yearning for greater flexibility, more reasonably priced tickets, etc., etc.? Simon, whenever I think of train tickets in this podcast, I think of that time that I think you were stood behind a French couple, was it, who were about to spend £8 million on a trip up to, I don't know, somewhere random like Derby. But did you step in and save the day or something like that? But it just makes me think of the weird ticketing we have in this country.
No, the person at the National Rail ticket counter at St Pancras Station in Intervention and told them that...
I would have owned that story. I would have been the hero in that story because I can't remember.
Or witness to this. It was a family of tourists and they were trying to buy train tickets to Derby.
Oh, God,
Train tickets to Derby. I think they were going to Alton Towers. You'd go to Derby to then try to go to Alton Towers, wouldn't you? And the lady behind the counter was like, if I sell you 4 return tickets now, to leave now to Derby, it's going to cost you. And it was something like £600. It was insane. Wow. She was like, but I'm not going to sell those to you. I'm not going to let you buy them. And then basically took them through the rigmarole of getting a rail card. And then if you wait another half an hour, and so on and so on, and managed to get the cost down to, you know, like £350 or something. Just a lot of money to go Derby and back in one day. No, train ticket prices are totally mental. Mm. Went away the other weekend, not on a train. Me and my wife went snowboarding for the weekend, and we were sitting in a restaurant having lunch, talking to a Norwegian couple, and they said they were coming to England. It's the train prices because they were going to Cornwall on the train. Train prices are very expensive though. And I said, yeah, they are. And then I told them how much it costs me to get to work every day. I said, yeah, it's my return ticket to work is £30 a day and it's 25 minutes on a train. They were like, what?
Yeah.
How much? They thought they'd misheard the amount. And that's not even what we're talking about here. We're talking about kind of long distance train tickets. No, they're insanely expensive. So anything that brings the cost down is a good thing.
But on your website, you have a story about an app that could make one area just a little bit more simple.
Yeah, this is quite a good idea, I think. Basically, this is to do with being able to upgrade your train ticket whilst you're on the train. One of the really annoying things about trains is that lots of them have first-class carriages on them that are totally empty or have hardly anybody in them. And then other people are standing up elsewhere or getting a raw deal, or you're looking at it thinking, well, what is, like, can I not just go sit in there? And this enables for you to go do that, but at far less than the cost of buying that first class ticket in advance.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, we all know that trains are stuck in the 80s, and there needs to be something that changes, you know, whether it's pushing the companies to lower prices or just trying to bring a bit more tech into, you know, ticket prices or whatever. But so SeatFrog was actually set up by these two guys who are over 6'4", and so they were always getting really fed up of sitting in standard class, which obviously has no leg room. So they basically tried to sneak into first class one day and got told off, and they thought, surely there's a better way of doing this. So they came up with with SeatFrog. And they essentially run a kind of eBay-like auction sort of thing. It's done really well. You know, they've got over 1 million users now, and they've partnered with every train company in the country. But tickets are still really expensive. So, you know, it's all well and good being able to get a first class ticket for a tenner when you're on the train. But if the train is still 80 quid, it's kind of like, well, I'll just kind of stay in standard. It doesn't really matter. So I think there is a long, long way to go. But I think it's really, really good to see someone trying to do something. Because we have so many sort of challenges in financial services and consumer stuff, but we just haven't really seen that in rail. So I'm a fan. I'm a big fan.
Anything that can help. All right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and this one and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.